Welcome to Just for the Health of It, where we bring you new perspectives on the science of health for all. We will bring you local, state, national, and global health news, as well as local guests for homegrown perspectives and connections to local resources. Here at Just for the Health of It, we bring you the best of both social justice and personal health. At Just for the Health of It, we focus on putting the just in Just for the Health of It. Our aim is to equip you to live healthily, in a healthy community, on a just planet. I am your host, Dan Rutt. I have a BS degree in biology and a master's degree in public health, specializing in nutrition. I have worked as a health educator, nutrition counselor, community health planner, and AIDS program director, not to mention dishwasher and busboy. I am a former president of the Ohio Public Health Association. This gig is one of several of my non-paying vocations, including lifelong social justice activist, political satirist, and poet. I am a longtime resident of the Old West End neighborhood in Toledo. Welcome to Just for the Health of It. Here we are, episode number 116. It's Monday, May 31st. I'm recording this from an undisclosed location that looks eerily like my den. Well, folks, we're living in a world that's increasingly divided between vaccinated and unvaccinated in both this country and around the world. But the U.S. did hit a milestone of having at least partially vaccinated one half of its population. Congratulations, but the world is another story. Let's start with a couple global stories. This one from The Hill. Vietnam identifies new, highly transmissible variant of coronavirus. Vietnam has detected a new, highly transmissible variant of the coronavirus, the Vietnamese health ministry announced Saturday. The variant, which is believed to have spurred a recent wave of COVID-19 infections in the country, has a mix of characteristics from both the strains first found in the United Kingdom and India, according to VN Express, an international newspaper. Okay, well, this story is important because the more virus replication we have around the world, the more likely we're going to get variants. And the more likely we get variants, the more likely we're going to run into ones that are more dangerous or more highly transmissible, which could, of course, be the same thing because the more people that get it are the more people that can die of COVID-19. Okay, well, next up, to get a bead on what the goals are for the planet as a whole, this from The Hill. The World Health Organization Director General calls for countries to vaccinate at least 10% of their populations by September. The World Health Organization's Director General called on all countries to vaccinate at least 10% of their populations by September and at least 30% by the end of 2021 in a, quote, drive to December. This is crucial to stop severe disease and death, keep our health workers safe, and reopen our societies and economies, he said. We must be very clear, the pandemic is not over, and it will not be over until and unless transmission is controlled in every last country, he said. The Director General pointed out that more than 75% of all vaccines have been administered so far in only 10 wealthy countries, noting that the number of shots would have been enough for all health workers and older people in the world. But right now, there is not enough supply. Countries that vaccinate children and other low-risk groups now do so at the expense of health workers and high-risk groups in other countries. That's the reality. And while the U.S. has seen high rates of vaccination compared to other nations, there is still a huge divide between the vaccinated and unvaccinated in this country. This from the Washington Post. The unseen COVID-19 risk for unvaccinated people. The country's declining COVID-19 case rates present an unrealistically optimistic perspective for half of the nation, the half that is still not vaccinated. As more people receive vaccines, COVID-19 cases are occurring mostly in the increasingly narrow slice of the unprotected population. So the Washington Post adjusted its case, death, and hospitalization rates to account for that, and found that in some places the virus continues to rage among those who haven't received a shot. The rosy national figures showing declining case numbers led the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention to loosen mask restrictions 2 weeks ago, and President Biden to advise people to take off their masks and smile. But adjustments for vaccination show the rate among susceptible unvaccinated people is 73% higher than the standard figures being publicized. With that adjustment, the national death rate is roughly the same as it was 2 months ago and is barely inching down. The adjusted hospitalization rate is as high as it was 3 months ago. The case rate is still declining after the adjustment. Unvaccinated people are getting the wrong message, experts said. They think it's safe to take off the mask. It's not, said Lynn Goldman, dean of the School of Public Health at George Washington University. It looks like fewer numbers, looks like it's getting better, but it's not necessarily better for those who aren't vaccinated. Maryland, Virginia, and the District of Columbia have adjusted rates below the national average. In the region, however, lower vaccination rates in the black community have concentrated cases there to an extraordinary degree. Before vaccines, black people were about one-third of new COVID-19 patients in Maryland and half in D.C. In the latest data, black people are just under half of the new cases in Maryland and more than 80% of the cases in D.C. Well, folks, there's two ways to be protected from COVID-19. One, to protect yourself, get vaccinated. Two, to protect those around you and in your community, get other people vaccinated or yourself vaccinated. Let's root for both. Please get vaccinated. Encourage those around you to do the same. Okay, well, let's do the local COVID-19 update. We continue to see cases decline locally as the Lucas County average of daily cases over the last week has dropped down to 35 from 44 the previous week. The number of Ohio counties that have high incidence remained the same at 26 of 88 counties. Our local county rate, Lucas County rate, is 124 per 100,000 people over a two-week period. In Ohio, it's 97. And if you'll remember, Ohio set a metric a while back, the governor did, that we would get rid of mitigation efforts and open back up when we get to under 50. So Ohio's at 97, almost twice that high still. So we're not out of this yet. But things are looking good as far as testing positivity rates. In Lucas County, our rate continues to drop quickly. We're down to 3.2% of those who've got tested testing positive, and this dropped from 4.5% the week before. So we're well under the 5% metric that indicates that we're doing adequate testing given the amount of transmission in the community. Congratulations, Lucas County. Woohoo! And Ohio is a slightly lower at 2.9%, and it's nice to see that Lucas County and Ohio's low rates are converging. We've been two times or more higher for much of the pandemic. So it's starting to even out, and it's evening out at a low level. Way to go, Buckeyes and Lucas County folks. Okay, nursing homes. We actually had a tick up of active cases the last week. We've had 10 active cases over the last 2 or 3 weeks, and we're up to 17 cases this most recent week. That's 8 residents and 9 staff with active COVID-19 infections. New hospitalizations are still trending down slowly in both Lucas County and Ohio in recent weeks. A good trend. Lucas County deaths over the last 14 days, 11. And this as a rate is similar to the Ohio and national death rates. But if we're looking nationally, we're still seeing over 600 deaths per day. And if you look at that on an annualized basis, that's 225,000 deaths a year. So remember, in the first year of the pandemic, we saw just under 600,000 deaths, and we're still cruising along at an annual rate of 225,000 deaths per year. It ain't over yet. Okay, well, those folks who have gotten at least one or more doses of the vaccine continue to increase as the U.S. gets over 50% of the U.S. population at 50.5%. And Ohio comes in at 45.3% of Ohio's population, and Lucas County a little bit lower at 44.6%. We've seen the percent of people vaccinated over the last 4 weeks continue to decline. For instance, Ohio has only had 5% of its population vaccinated over the last 4 weeks compared to 6.2% nationally. So we're lagging in the total number and the rate of vaccinations. Unfortunately, Lucas County does even worse than Ohio with 4.6% of our population vaccinated in the last 4 weeks. Okay, the racial ethnic disparities in Lucas County and Ohio continue to get slightly like 1% better each week. And we're up to Lucas County blacks only 55% as likely to be vaccinated as whites. Ohio does somewhat better at 65%. Okay, folks, you're listening to the People's School of Public Health in the University of Life. This is WAKT We Act Radio, 106.1 FM Toledo. Okay, well, let's get on with more news and research in public health. And we're going to spend the vast majority of the show talking about non-COVID public health issues. Yay! It is about time. The show is opening up from the pandemic. Okay, let's start off with a story from The Guardian. Number of smokers has reached all-time high of 1.1 billion, study finds. That's worldwide. Smoking killed almost 8 million people in 2019, and the number of smokers rose as the habit was picked up by young people around the world, according to new research. A study published in The Lancet said efforts to curb the habit had been outstripped by population growth, with 150 more people smoking in the 9 years from 1990, reaching an all-time high of 1.1 billion. The study authors and governments need to focus on reducing the uptake of smoking among young people, as 89% of new smokers were addicted by the age of 25, but beyond that age were unlikely to start. Young people are particularly vulnerable to addiction, and with high rates of cessation remaining elusive worldwide, the tobacco epidemic will continue for years to come unless countries can dramatically reduce the number of new smokers starting each year. The study's lead author, Marissa Reitzma, a researcher at the Institute for Health Metrics and Evaluation, said, though the prevalence of smoking has reduced globally over the past 3 decades, it's increased for men in 20 countries and for women in 12. Just 10 countries make up 2/3 of the world's smoking population: China, India, Indonesia, the U.S., Russia, Bangladesh, Japan, Turkey, Vietnam, and the Philippines. 1 in 3 smokers, 341 million, live in China. In 2019, smoking was associated with 1.7 million deaths from ischemic heart disease, 1.6 million deaths from chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, 1.3 million deaths from tracheal, bronchus, or lung cancer, and nearly 1 million deaths from stroke. Previous studies have shown that at least half of long-term smokers will die from causes directly linked to smoking, and that smokers have an average life expectancy 10 years lower than those who have never smoked. According to the study, half of all countries had made no progress in stopping uptake among 15 to 24-year-olds, and the average age for someone to start was 19 when it is legal in most places. Despite 182 countries signing a 2005 Convention on Tobacco Control, enforcing policies to reduce smoking has been varied. Researchers said taxation was the most effective policy, but there was significant discrepancy between the high cost of a packet of cigarettes in developed countries and a significantly lower cost in low and middle-income countries. The study's co-author, Vin Gupta, said there needed to be a stronger commitment to tackling smoking, as well as products such as flavored cigarettes and e-cigarettes that are enticing to young people. Despite progress in some countries, tobacco industry interference and waning political commitment have resulted in a large and persistent gap between knowledge and action on global tobacco control, said Gupta. Bans on advertising, promotion, and sponsorship must extend to internet-based media, but only 1 in 4 countries have comprehensively banned all forms of direct and indirect advertising. Okay, well, while the United States has made much more progress than many other countries, tobacco is still the single largest preventable cause of death in this country. And we get this from the American Heart Association. Leading global cardiovascular organizations released joint opinion on achieving the, quote, tobacco endgame. Tobacco use continues to be a primary contributor to the global burden of disease, causing an estimated 12% of deaths worldwide among people aged 30 and over. 4 leading cardiovascular organizations, the American Heart Association, the American College of Cardiology, the European Society of Cardiology, and the World Heart Federation, released a joint opinion calling for greater action on the global scale to end the tobacco epidemic once and for all. The organizations are urging governments to take immediate action to implement the World Health Organization's M-Power framework, which outlines 6 essential policy approaches proven to reduce tobacco use: monitor tobacco use and prevention policies, protect people from tobacco smoke, offer help to quit tobacco use, warn about the dangers of tobacco, enforce bans of tobacco advertising, promotion, and sponsorship, and raise taxes on tobacco. The joint opinion outlines comprehensive tobacco prevention strategies that are necessary to fully implement the MPOWER framework, including lowering the nicotine concentrations in all combustible tobacco products, further research to understand the health impacts of nicotine on the cardiovascular system and the long-term effects of electronic cigarettes, enforcement of strong systems and pre-market assessments of all tobacco products, strong regulation of tobacco industry marketing to ensure false health claims are not made about products that have not been thoroughly researched and authorized through regulatory review, greater global action to remove all non-tobacco flavored products from the market, raising the price of all tobacco products through excise taxes and other means, youth-targeted counter-marketing campaigns to effectively reduce tobacco use among youth, access to comprehensive evidence-based cessation services as a safer alternative for adults who wish to quit smoking combustible cigarettes. Despite global reductions in tobacco use, the growing popularity of electronic cigarettes and other newer tobacco products that appeal to youth with flavoring threatens progress towards ending tobacco use and nicotine addiction, the tobacco end game. Countries must effectively regulate electronic cigarettes and other emerging tobacco products to protect young people and improve public health worldwide. And for you listeners who yourself or have friends who are trying to quit smoking, you can call and get assistance free from 1-800-QUIT-NOW. That's 1-800-QUIT-NOW. While the U.S. medical system has made progress over recent decades in dealing with tobacco use, our medical system has done a much poorer job dealing with alcohol abuse and alcoholism. This from Science Daily. Heavy drinkers see doctors regularly, but few receive treatment for a disorder. Some 16 million Americans are believed to have alcohol use disorder, and an estimated 93,000 people in the U.S. die from alcohol-related causes each year. Both of these numbers are expected to grow as a result of heavier drinking during the COVID-19 pandemic. Yet, in a new study involving data from more than 200,000 people with and without alcohol problems, researchers at Washington University School of Medicine in St. Louis found that although the vast majority of those with alcohol use disorder see their doctors regularly for a range of issues, fewer than 1 in 10 ever get treatment for drinking. Analyzing data gathered from 2015 through 2019 via the National Survey on Drug Use and Health, the researchers found that about 8% of those surveys met the criteria for alcohol use disorder, the medical diagnosis for those with an addiction to alcohol. Of those people who met the criteria, 81% had received medical care in a doctor's office or spent time in a hospital or clinic during the previous year, but only 12% reported they had been advised to cut down on their drinking, 5% were offered information about treatment, and 6% actually received treatment, some of whom were not referred by their doctors but sought out treatment on their own. It's not that these people aren't in the healthcare system, said first author Carrie Mintz, an assistant professor of psychiatry, but although they see doctors regularly, the vast majority aren't getting the help they need. The researchers found that although most people with alcohol use disorder had access to healthcare, and although 70% reported they had been asked about alcohol use, that's where the care stopped. Some primary care doctors may not feel comfortable telling patients they should cut down on drinking, prescribing medication to help them cut back, or referring them to treatment because they don't specialize in treating alcohol misuse. But the result is that many people who need treatment aren't getting it, said senior author Laura Jane Beirut, the alumni-endowed professor of psychiatry. We used to see the same thing with smoking, but when physicians became educated about smoking and learned that many of their patients wanted to quit or cut back, doctors began offering more treatment, and more people were able to quit. We think the same thing may be possible with alcohol. Among treatments that could be prescribed are the FDA-approved medications naltrexone, acamprosate, and disulfiram, as well as psychotherapy and mutual aid approaches, such as the 12-step program used by Alcoholics Anonymous. Alcohol use disorder is a chronic disease, but compared to other chronic diseases, it's wildly untreated, Beirut said. For example, 2/3 of patients with HIV and 95% of patients with diabetes receive treatment, compared with only 6% of people with alcohol use disorder. The research noted that during the pandemic, alcohol sales in the U.S. increased by 34%. Consequently, they expect that as the country emerges from COVID-19 and returns towards normal, the number of people with alcohol use disorder will have climbed. We know alcohol use and misuse have increased during the pandemic, Mintz said. It seems there has been a shift towards heavier drinking. Plus, many doctor's offices, AA groups, and other support groups were shut down for a period of time. So we would hypothesize that even the relatively small percentage of people in treatment may have declined during the past year. Well, it looks like referral for treatment for alcohol use disorder is a leading candidate for the most improved possibility in the future. So get at it, medical system. Okay, well, next up from Science Daily. Regarding cognitive functioning, women impaired more by smoking, men impaired more by cardiovascular disease. In the largest study, the associations between smoking and cardiovascular disease on cognitive function, researchers at the Translational Genomics Research Institute, an affiliate of City of Hope, found both impair the ability to learn and memorize, and that the effects of smoking are more pronounced among females, while males are more impaired by cardiovascular disease. Previous attempts to quantify cognitive function among smokers and assess sex differences produced mixed results. The Translational Genomics Research Institute researchers attribute this to the limited size of previous data sets. By analyzing data representing more than 70,000 individuals worldwide, generated through the researchers' online cognitive test called MindCrowd, the current study produced results that indicate definitive trends. These results suggest that smoking and cardiovascular disease impact verbal learning and memory throughout adulthood, starting as early as age 18, said Matt Hentelman, professor of neurogenomics, a MindCrowd founder, and the study's senior author. Smoking is associated with decreased learning and memory function in women, while cardiovascular disease is associated with decreased learning and memory function in men. Besides Alzheimer's disease, the most significant cause of cognitive decline is known as, quote, vascular contributions to cognitive impairment and dementia, or VCID, which arises from stroke and other vascular brain injuries that cause significant changes to memory, thinking, and behavior. Smoking and cardiovascular disease both exacerbate these vascular contributions to cognitive impairment and dementia. The reasons for these sex modification effects are not entirely understood, said Candace Lewis, a postdoctoral fellow in the lab and the study's lead author. Our findings highlight the importance of considering biological sex in studying vascular contributions to cognitive impairment and dementia. This study's findings are important, Dr. Lewis said. Since cigarette smoking is the nation's leading cause of preventable disease and death, accounting for nearly 1 in 5 deaths, and cardiovascular disease is the leading cause of disease and death worldwide and is an important predictor of cognitive decline. Vascular diseases are also associated with increased risk of Alzheimer's, which is the nation's 6th leading cause of death. Okay, well, high blood pressure is the most prevalent risk factor for cardiovascular disease in America, and we have this story from Science Daily. Many people with high blood pressure are taking another medication that could raise their high blood pressure. Nearly 1 in 5 adults with high blood pressure, a leading risk factor for heart disease and stroke, also take a medicine that could be elevating their blood pressure, according to a new research presented at the American College of Cardiology's 70th annual scientific session. The results underscore the need for patients to routinely review all the medications they take with their care team, including those available over the counter, to make sure none could be interfering with blood pressure lowering efforts. Which are the most likely culprits? Based on the study's findings, the 3 most common classes of medications were antidepressants, nonsteroidal anti-inflammatory drugs, or NSAIDs, which include ibuprofen and naproxen, and oral steroids used to treat conditions such as gout, lupus, rheumatoid arthritis, or after an organ transplant. Other medications associated with blood pressure elevation were also reported, including antipsychotics, certain oral contraceptives, and popular decongestants. Researchers said that these findings raise concerns, especially as nearly half of Americans diagnosed with high blood pressure do not have it sufficiently controlled. Among participants with high blood pressure, 19% reported using one or more blood pressure raising medications, and 4% reporting using multiple of those medications. Nearly one quarter of women with high blood pressure reported using a blood pressure raising medication, compared with 14% of men. Okay, next up, we're going to stick to the theme of hypertension, but we're going to switch over the theme for the next few stories to racial ethnic disparities. This from Medical Express. The link between structural racism, high blood pressure, and black people's health. High blood pressure, structural racism, what do they have in common? Researchers say they are two of the biggest factors responsible for the gap in poor heart and brain health between black and white adults in the United States, and they are inextricably linked. Studies show high blood pressure, also called hypertension, affects black adults, particularly women, earlier and more dramatically than their white peers. By age 55, research shows 3 of 4 black adults have already developed the condition, compared to about half of white men and 40% of white women. Untreated high blood pressure can lead to a range of disabling and potentially fatal chronic diseases, including heart disease, stroke, dementia, kidney disease, sexual dysfunction, and loss of vision. Behind these elevated risks, researchers say, are a complex web of negative influences stemming from the multi-generational impacts of structural racism. Chandra Jackson, a research investigator and epidemiologist with the National Institute of Environmental Health Sciences, considers structural racism as the totality of ways in which societies foster racial discrimination through mutually reinforcing systems of housing, education, employment, wages, benefits, credit, media, healthcare, and criminal justice. These patterns and practices in turn reinforce discriminatory beliefs, values, and the maldistribution of health-promoting or harming resources, she said. That is, they create the physical and social environments that make it easier for white families to grow up healthy and harder for black families to do so. For example, decades of discriminatory lending called redlining have kept black families segregated in neighborhoods with fewer resources and greater chronic exposure to environmental hazards, such as unclean drinking water and noise and air pollution, Jackson said. These neighborhoods also tend to lack quality healthcare facilities and providers, grocery stores that sell healthy and affordable foods, or open spaces where adults can exercise and children can play, she said. Discriminatory employment and educational systems result in higher levels of poverty that create financial strain, housing and food insecurity, strained relationships, and less access to good health insurance. All of this, along with the daily indignities of racial discrimination, increases stress. That, in turn, may be associated with increased blood pressure, said Augustine Kang, an investigator at Brown University School of Public Health. All these factors set up the perfect storm for disease. Overall, black men and women report higher levels of stress than their white counterparts. But studies show black women who experience the compounding effects of both race and gender discrimination, along with the chronic stress of having to work harder to overcome this dual bias, pay a particularly high price with their health starting early in life. Black women have shorter life expectancy than white women, in part due to higher rates of heart disease. Stress also makes it harder to manage heart and brain health risk factors, such as high blood pressure, once they take hold. King led a study that found black women with high blood pressure who experienced high levels of stress were substantially less likely to take medication or practice blood pressure-lowering behaviors, such as exercising or eating a healthy diet. Lifestyle factors are incredibly important in managing blood pressure, he said. There are social and environmental factors that present an added barrier to diet and physical activity, which accounts for a lot of the health disparities we see today. We cannot rely just on the efforts of individuals and doctors, he said. You need a well-functioning healthcare delivery system. Asking people to improve their diet when they don't have access to healthy foods, to exercise when they don't have access to safe or affordable spaces, to take blood pressure medications when they can't afford them, while also failing to ensure access to quality universal health care, will never succeed in limiting health inequities, said Dr. Manika Safford, founder and co-director of the Cornell Center for Health Equity. She also is chief of general internal medicine at Cornell Medical College. We can't leave it up to individuals. It's not their fault. The system is set up to fail them. The system is not fair, equal, and equitable. Okay, well, to drive that point home of racism and healthcare, this from Fierce Healthcare. In many U.S. cities, most and least racially inclusive hospitals are neighbors. A Loan Institute analysis of the most and least racially inclusive U.S. hospitals found that providers on both ends of the spectrum can be located just a short cab ride away from each other in many cities. The group's president also warned that care delivery can greatly differ between these segregated organizations. A new Loan Institute ranking of the U.S. hospitals' racial inclusivity suggests that many of the county's most segregated hospitals are in urban areas and that top and bottom performers are frequently located within the same city. Further, Loan's analysis placed more than twice as many, quote, elite hospitals named to U.S. News' honor roll in the bottom third for racial inclusivity than it did in the upper third. The difference between the most and least inclusive hospitals is stark, especially when they are blocks away from each other, Vika Sayani, president of the Loan Institute. As the nation reckons with racial injustice, we cannot overlook our health system. Hospital leaders have responsibility to better serve people of color and create a more equitable future. Philadelphia, New Jersey, and New York City, Manhattan were the most segregated cities, with the largest proportion of their total hospitals falling into one extreme or another. If you want to see structural racism, just look at big city hospitals during COVID. Hospitals with a history of serving communities of color need refrigerator trucks to hold bodies of deceased patients, while wealthier hospitals nearby had empty beds. And in another area for medical racism in the healthcare system, this from Stat News. Academic medical centers need to go beyond statements condemning racism. As predictable as mushrooms popping up after rain, condemnation of racism from leaders at academic medical centers and acknowledging it as a public health crisis began emerging almost moments after a Minneapolis jury found former police officer Derek Chauvin guilty of murdering George Floyd. There's no doubt that speaking out against racism is valuable, but it often isn't backed up by effective leadership to enact policies that will actually combat institutional racism. I'm black, a woman, an immigrant, an academic, a scientist, and a physician. The world of academic medical centers is one in which personally mediated racism, internalized racism, and institutional racism thrive. It is an environment in which I and others like me are not only subject to racism, but witness the consequences of it for the patients we serve. Anti-racism statements by academic leaders often include links to resources such as counseling programs, microaggression training, and platforms for reporting discrimination. While important, these put the onus to act on the victims and the witnesses, get counseling to cope, report, or intervene. While helpful, these are the wrong groups to target. Department chairs, division heads, deans, program directors, and C-suite executives are the ones who need to be involved in driving institutional change. To counter institutional racism in academic medical centers, leaders must do far more than make anti-racism statements. Action is needed at the institutional policy level. Barring an acronym usually used for goal setting, anti-racism should be SMART, that's S-M-A-R-T, specific, measurable, attainable, realistic, and time-bound. I have four practical recommendations for academic leaders seeking change. First, make sure your anti-racism statements include definitive actions that have been taken or will be taken to combat racism at the policy level at your organization. These include, but aren't limited to, anti-racism plans developed by every department, mitigation of barriers to recruitment of not just minority faculty, but of minority faculty to executive leadership positions, implicit bias assessment and workshops for every individual participating in medical, student intern, resident, fellow, and faculty selection processes, and committing significant financial resources to racial equity and justice research. Second, compensate, reward, and recognize the diversity, equity, inclusion work done by minority faculty members. That work consumes our time and often our emotions. We do it because we feel responsibility as minorities in predominantly white spaces to make things better and easier for the next generation. We do it because we are asked to, and because if we don't, often no one else will. We do it in addition to our other academic responsibilities, and we do not get recognized for it when it comes to promotion and tenure. That should change. Third, stratify de-identified patient outcome data available regarding the clinical services the medical center provides, not just by race and ethnicity, but by zip code within the institution's catchment area. Zip codes predict life expectancy and health. Use this information to pinpoint where institutional resources are needed to combat racial inequity, which is inextricably intertwined with health inequity. This information does not have to be made public available, but it should be discussed when major financial decisions regarding clinical services are made and should influence those decisions. Fourth, Send an anonymous survey to every trainee and employee to gather information that will be used to start conversations about their experiences in relation to racism and diversity. You may find that as an institution, you are not doing as well as you think you are. Be ready to have hard conversations based on what you find. Being an anti-racist organization takes more than having a diversity officer, an Office of Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion, mandatory microaggression or cultural sensitivity training, and statements of condemnation after a black person is killed by the police or an Asian American person is assaulted or verbally attacked by someone spewing hateful rhetoric. Without action that leads to institutional policy change, such as recruiting and supporting minority faculty, and the use of health outcome data to geographically target clinical services, anti-racism statements from leaders in academia are just window dressing. Next up, we have a story from Stat News, another editorial from a minority physician. Doctors should talk about race and racism with their patients. Here's how. "Why do black lives matter?" a patient asked me. "Why can't all lives matter?" It was just a few weeks into my residency, and I hadn't been expecting a patient to ask me that question. I certainly wasn't trained to respond to it, even though I, along with many of my colleagues, wore Black Lives Matter pins. The patient, who identified as white, looked at me, an Asian American physician, with curiosity. Was it even my place to answer, I thought? Both doctors and patients can have unconscious biases that affect medical care. Yet medical education has fallen behind in teaching physicians how to initiate and continue dialogues with their patients about race and racism. One of the many things physicians must do is ask their patients probing personal and often sensitive questions. Patients sometimes ask probing questions back, and doctors are expected to answer them honestly. In taking a social history, which is part of an initial encounter with a patient, we learn about a person's job, substance abuse, sex life, and more. Race hasn't been a standard part of this inventory, but it should be. In the United States, structural inequities based on race have been one of the most powerful determinants of socioeconomic status and health. People from racial ethnic minority groups are more likely to encounter limited access to safe housing, healthy food, job opportunities, and education, all factors that negatively affect physical and mental health. Racial disparities are also costly. One analysis projected an economic gain of $135 billion per year if the U.S. eliminated racial disparities in health. The main way most doctors get information about race is through the intake form patients fill out. These forms usually include a checkbox with the following options: white, non-Hispanic, white, Hispanic, black, American Indian or Alaskan Native, Asian, or other. This information may tell a doctor a patient's racial identity, but it says nothing about their experience in that racial identity. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention has created guidelines to help clinicians take a sexual history. No such official framework exists for talking about race. To help doctors start having these conversations with their patients, I worked with my mentor, Daniel Olveski, a geriatrician, hospitalist, and interim director of the Center for Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion at Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center in Boston, to adapt guidelines from several sources. Our goal is to make asking about patients' racial experiences a standard part of a social history. Such conversations need to start by creating a safe space in which to have an open dialogue. Context statements like, "I want to learn more about you beyond your medical problems so I can take better care of you," can help open the door. Like any aspect of taking a patient's history, the question should start broadly with questions like, "What aspects of your background or identity are important to you?" Or, "Some people find that their race, religion, or culture is important for their health. Is that how you feel?" Another important component of understanding a person's medical experiences is by asking directly, "Have you ever experienced discrimination in the healthcare system? If so, was it based on skin color, accent, gender, sexual orientation, or other reason?" A yes answer is worth exploring, since eliciting more details can help a doctor avoid saying or doing something that could be seen as offensive. In light of police killings of black people and the upswing in hate crimes against Asian Americans, doctors should also address racism directly. Writing in the New England Journal of Medicine, James Lee, a psychiatry resident at the University of Washington School of Medicine, suggests that doctors ask their patients, "Are you more anxious today because of racism, or do you avoid doing specific things or specific locations because of fears of discrimination?" An exploration of race and racism isn't just about the patient. Doctors should also reflect on their own biases and ask themselves if aspects of a patient's appearance, ethnicity, accent, personality, or behavior might influence them in ways to lead to anything less than top quality care. "I hadn't thought of any of this when my patient asked me why black lives matter. I could tell It was an important question for her, so I did my best to answer. We talked for half an hour, discussing the centuries of oppression black people have endured and how the deaths of George Floyd and Breonna Taylor, among the many black lives lost to police brutality, shed light on racism and injustice. I tried to make the point that until black lives, which historically haven't counted, truly matter, all lives can't matter. The conversation wasn't perfect and was at times uncomfortable for me, but I chose to have it with my patient. Engagement is really the first step. Having one-on-one conversations with patients about race and racism is part of a larger movement to tackle systemic racism in the healthcare system. It requires patience, as these dialogues may not finish in one setting, but it's crucial they happen. Doctors need to extend social histories to include questions on racial identity and disparities. The goal is to make asking patients about race as common as asking them about smoking habits and contraception. Some patients may not want to talk about racial identity or their experiences with racism, and that's their prerogative. But doctors will never know who does want to talk about it unless they start the conversation. Doing that will improve care for all patients. Okay, well, just one comment. I just want to note that, of course, all of this is layered upon the reality that capitalism is endemic in our healthcare system, and that the amount of time that physicians have to speak about things is very much limited and very difficult to keep adding new things. So we have to deal with capitalism as well as racism. If you can disentwine those two, let me know. And in that vein, this from Stat News: let's banish the term patient from the healthcare lexicon. Almost every industry has changed the term for the people they serve. We are now passengers, guests, members, customers, and more. The big exception? Healthcare. To those in the field, whether it's clinicians or researchers or pharmaceutical marketers, we are all patients. Even when we feel fine and aren't in a hospital or doctor's office. It's time to stop categorizing people this way, which puts them in submissive and dehumanizing roles. Imagine what would happen if clinicians called the people they treat clients or activated consumers or partners. With that mindset, they move away from implying what they will do to or for them and instead describe what they do with them as proactive partners. These new terms aren't just more respectful, they're more in touch with the times. Today's activated consumers are ready to take more responsibility for their healthcare. In a healthcare consumer survey conducted by my colleagues at Deloitte in April and May of 2020, just weeks into the COVID-19 shutdowns in the U.S., 72% of respondents noted that they understand their health and well-being needs and actively work with their doctors to set goals that work for them. And more than 50% said they are comfortable telling their doctors if they disagree with them. Health is an essential resource and most people want to take charge of it. With healthcare clients in the driver's seat, they become the captains of their own destiny by working with a healthcare team they trust and can communicate with as partners in their health journeys. They hold themselves accountable for their choices, and they advance past today's episodic interactions with healthcare to continuous connectivity, reaching out to their healthcare teams whenever and however they need. This empowered approach can help individuals transform their focus from disease to wellness. When I opened my first primary care office in Tallahassee, Florida, my practice grew quickly. Fresh out of residency, I was younger than most of the adults seeking my care. To bridge any age gaps, I created a dialogue with them. I wanted to acknowledge my expertise about healthcare while also respecting their wisdom about their own health, bodies, and needs. I believe that having that kind of conversation could be the most significant way that healthcare providers set expectations for the client care team relationship. I sat down with each new client and said, "Your ship is your body and you are the captain of your ship. Your job is to keep your ship in the best possible condition to take you through your life's voyage. Your body is the only one you'll get. You may have the opportunity to get a tune-up or swap a part, but you don't get a whole new body. This conversation is to see if I qualify to be your first mate or advisor." I tried to quickly establish the roles we would each play in this relationship. I would tell clients it is my role to advise them, present a relevant care plan, prescribe the most appropriate medications and testing, suggest specialists when needed, and recommend the maintenance that includes preventive care and lifestyle changes. Their job is to decide whether or not to implement my suggestions. The response: "You aren't from around here, are you?" A few people never returned, but those who stayed learned about their health as well as their ailments. We, the clients, their support networks of family and friends, and the clinical team that included several colleagues and me, worked together so clients could take more control and responsibility for their health. Within 9 months, our daily schedule was full and we couldn't take on new patients. Despite having double the number of clients of other primary care practices in our region, ours had higher than average satisfaction scores. I was perceived as spending 8 more minutes with my clients than my colleagues, even though the reality was I spent less time. How was that possible? It was the way my staff and I managed our workflow, the structure of visits, and the processes we put in place so everyone could work at the top of their licenses. This left me additional time to focus on individual client interactions and listen to their concerns. Our clients owned their care plans, and as members of the team, helped measure results and suggested adjustments along the way. That's different from the way things work in most clinical environments, where several individual plans might be created by different physicians, often without input from the individual or their family. Many, though not all, of our clients achieve significant results such as managing blood sugar and blood pressure, losing weight, and becoming more active because of the environment and culture we created. It was exciting for me and my colleagues to watch clients learn and incorporate real-time care plans that not only slowed disease, but for those who changed their lifestyle, even reversed it. The people we most empowered ended up visiting us the least because they improved and better managed their health, as it should be. Even though I delivered my first client-centric care more than 20 years ago, the idea of focusing care on the person, today it's often called patient-centric care, is still in its infancy. From a humanizing healthcare perspective, prioritizing this shift towards rewards for all stakeholders, such as a more satisfying experience with the healthcare system, better outcomes, more efficiency in the system, better access to care, and a more sustainable ecosystem. I have seen firsthand the advantages that can emerge from this shift, and I believe it is an essential piece for humanizing healthcare. By embracing a client-centric model, the various players within the industry will be able to restore the health connection in healthcare, empower clients to take charge of their health, disease, lifestyle, and care options, and inject compassion and empathy into the science of medicine. To start this journey, it is necessary to consider people as, quote, clients rather than, quote, patients, a word I am doing my best to banish from my vocabulary. Okay, well, next up is an aspect of how capitalism often doesn't serve our healthcare industry, this regarding the pharmaceutical industry, this from Stat News. Restore a better balance to public-private funding of biomedical research. The pharmaceutical industry says that if the U.S. reduces the astronomical drug prices paid by U.S. consumers, life-saving innovation will be devastated. That is not true. There are ways for the U.S. to reduce drug prices while maintaining and perhaps even accelerating its innovation engine. In recent decades, the United States has largely privatized its biomedical research and development, not by intention, but by default. A Research America analysis shows that private industry accounted for two-thirds of the $194 billion spent on biomedical R&D in the U.S. in 2018. When the analysis was completed, while spending by the federal government comprised just 22%, most of which came from the $37 billion funded by the National Institutes of Health. The private sector dominates biomedical R&D in the U.S. for two reasons. One is that Congress tightly controls yearly appropriations for the NIH, with the result that it funds only a fraction of the grant applications it receives. Take the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases, led by Anthony Fauci, which is the beating heart of work to combat the COVID-19 pandemic and other infectious diseases. This year, it is funding only about one-sixth of the applications it received from researchers who are trying to fight the vast array of potential infectious threats to Americans. COVID-19, to be sure, but also Zika, dengue fever, novel influenza viruses, Ebola, antibiotic-resistant superbugs, and more. The second reason is that companies have the money to spend. Congress has granted private industry virtually free rein in setting drug prices, resulting in huge profits. Because of federal patent protections and grants of exclusivity, many drugs in the U.S. face virtually no price competition for decades after they come to the market. Industry has even devised ingenious ways through constructing so-called patent thickets to delay the entry of competitors well beyond when patents should have expired. And consolidation among generic drug companies has reduced competition in that sector. There's nothing wrong with strong R&D funding by the biopharmaceutical industry. To the contrary, I believe that is essential for having a vibrant healthcare sector. But the balance in the U.S. between public and private funding for R&D is off kilter. Public funding is the primary engine for genuine scientific breakthroughs that industry ultimately brings to market. In fact, industry biomedical R&D depends on federal funding of research by those working in universities, nonprofit hospitals, and research institutes to generate the novel ideas that have the potential to conquer, with industry help, the nation's major killers and cripplers. Take the story behind one of the most remarkable biomedical advances in human history, the mRNA vaccine, which most people now know as Moderna or Pfizer. The work that made this vaccine possible occurred over decades at Vanderbilt University, Massachusetts Institute of Technology, the University of Pennsylvania, and the NIH itself, mostly funded with federal dollars. No NIH funding, no mRNA vaccine. Here's the lurking question. How many more mRNA-like breakthroughs would be possible if the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Disease funded one-third or one-half of its grant applications rather than just one-sixth? The NIH is more likely to tackle important research that is financially unappealing to industry because markets for applications might seem small or target economically disadvantaged populations. Pharma companies are not pursuing them because they aren't likely to be profitable, but that won't stop the NIH. And it is not uncommon for financially unappealing problems to yield fundamental biologic insights that transform healthcare forever. How can this imbalance be corrected and more publicly funded R&D be supported? By having Medicare pay less for prescription drugs and using those savings to fund NIH research. Here's one way this might work. The Elijah Cummings Lower Drug Costs Now Act, H.R. 3, which passed the House of Representatives, would give the federal government new authority to negotiate Medicare drug prices for commonly used pharmaceuticals. This is expected to save about $500 billion over 10 years. The proposed law would direct to the NIH almost $8 billion over 10 years. It's just a down payment on what's needed, but it's a start. In addition to providing additional public funding for research, reining in high prescription drug prices would provide much-needed financial relief to Americans who would pay less for their medications. U.S. drug prices are currently unsustainable. Americans pay multiples of what citizens of other countries pay for medications, forcing some to incur crippling debt and forego needed medication. It also contributes to soaring premiums that make insurance unaffordable for tens of millions of Americans. Concerns that cutting industry profits would harm sustained innovation and the future of health of Americans would be offset by increasing federal research funding, leading to more truly decisive scientific breakthroughs. Industry avoids essential basic research because it doesn't yield short-term profits, but once publicly funded innovations are far long enough, industry can develop them to make fundamental advances in human health. The U.S. needs an optimal balance of public and private research and responsible management of healthcare dollars. By directing funds saved through reduced drug prices to NIH and other public research investments, we can achieve all of these things while also making industry investment in research more efficient and productive, giving it better ideas to commercialize and curb what we spend on prescription drugs. Okay, well, let's switch gears and do a couple climate change stories. This from The Guardian. Climate disasters caused more internal displacement than war in 2020. Intense storms and flooding triggered three times more displacements than violent conflicts did last year, as the number of people internally displaced worldwide hit the highest record level. There were at least 55 million internally displaced people by the end of last year, according to figures published by the Norwegian Refugees Council Internal Displacement Monitoring Center. There were more than twice as many people displaced within their own country as forced out of their country as refugees. The number is the highest on record, but in line with its steady rise over the past decade. During a year that was the warmest on record, 5 million more people were displaced than in 2019. About 20 million internally displaced people were children under age 15, and 2.6 million were over 65. Most live in low and middle income countries. Alexander Bilak, the director, said it is particularly concerning that these high figures were recorded against the backdrop of the COVID-19 pandemic, when movement restrictions obstructed data collection and fewer people sought out emergency shelters for fear of infection. Today's displacement crisis arises from many interconnected factors, including climate and environmental change, protracted conflicts, and political instability. In a world made more fragile by the COVID-19 pandemic, sustained political will and investment in locally owned solutions will be more important than ever. The Norwegian Refugee Council Secretary General Jan Egeland added, "It's shocking that someone was forced to flee their home inside their own country every single second last year. We are failing to protect the world's most vulnerable people from conflict and disasters." And in more climate-related health news, this from New Scientist. Greenland's ice sheet is releasing huge amounts of mercury into rivers. An ice sheet in the southwestern region of Greenland is releasing huge amounts of mercury into nearby rivers. The discovery is worrying as the toxic metal can accumulate in the marine animals that are a key dietary component for local indigenous communities. Mercury is a naturally occurring metal found in some rocks. As glaciers slowly flow downhill, they grind up the underlying rocks, potentially releasing mercury into their meltwater. Mercury concentrations in this region are at least 10 times higher than in an average river. This means that meltwater is as rich in mercury as some highly polluted rivers, except in this case, the mercury hasn't been introduced into the water directly by humans. Although this mercury isn't introduced by humans, the ice sheet is melting much faster as a result of climate change. The mercury concentrations are among the highest ever recorded in the scientific literature for natural waters not contaminated by human activity. Mercury is one of the core elements of global concern because of its toxicity as it accumulates in food webs. As you go further up the food chain, mercury becomes more concentrated. This is especially concerning for members of the indigenous communities living in the Arctic. It is a region that contains both lots of melting glaciers and indigenous communities that rely heavily on harvested marine animals from local waters as a food source, said Maya Bhatia at the University of Alberta in Canada, who wasn't involved in this study. Okay, well, I want to end today's show with some good news. As I've reported earlier, engineering of roads has led to much increased safety and reduced traffic fatalities a lot in recent generations, but there's still a lot of room for improvement. This from Medical Express. Safe system approach could dramatically reduce road deaths while improving equity. A new approach to road safety that relies on design and engineering principles, the safe system approach, could lead to dramatic reductions in vehicle-related deaths and injuries if implemented in the U.S., according to a report from a consortium of experts convened by researchers at the Johns Hopkins School of Public Health. According to the National Safety Council, highway deaths increased 8% last year over the previous year, even though people were driving considerably less, with an estimated 42,000 deaths in motor vehicle crashes and 4.8 million injuries. Since 2009, the traffic death rate has remained relatively steady at about 11 deaths per 100,000 population, and crashes have persisted as the leading cause of death among young people. The rate of traffic deaths in the U.S. declined sharply between the 1960s and 1990, largely as a result of the car safety revolution. The traditional strategy for road safety in the U.S., the authors note, puts much of the burden of responsibility on the people driving, walking, or cycling on the roads. By contrast, the safe system approach is designed to place a greater burden on the design of roads and vehicles. Normal human lapses in judgment or diligence are expected, and roads are configured so that such errors do not lead to death or serious injury, the co-authors write. Even with a forgiving design, crashes will occur in a safe system, so roads are designed to limit crash forces to survivable levels. Specific design changes in a safe system include lane reductions. On some multi-line roads where pedestrians and bicyclists are present, that helps slow vehicles and give drivers more time to react. Flashing beacons that alert drivers to pedestrian crosswalks. Roundabouts that slow traffic through dangerous intersections and prevent deadly side impact collisions. Median barriers that, when used in some rural divided highways, reduce head-on collisions. As the authors of the report note, studies of safe system measures indicate that as they lead to dramatic drops in traffic deaths, for example, a roughly 80% reduction in severe crashes after the installation of roundabouts, and a 97% reduction in high-energy head-on collisions with median barriers. Overall, the safe system approach has been linked to substantial traffic fatality reductions. Countries that adopted the approach in the 1990s show large drops in deaths between 1990 and 2017, with a 47% reduction in Australia, 48% reduction in New Zealand, 80% reduction in Spain, and a 67% reduction in Sweden. One of the Biden administration's clearest priorities is to redress a history of underinvestment in road safety in communities of color, and the authors recommend that the safe system approach be used to do this. Some communities currently have much more than their share of exposure to traffic-related hazards due to larger thoroughfares going through their neighborhoods, for example, and/or fewer safety measures. It's how our transportation system developed over the years, but we now have an opportunity to change our approach. The report's recommendations include requiring the safe system principles be followed when federal funds are used for road design and operation, and setting up special programs to implement safe system measures in historically underserved communities. Okay, well, if you can't get enough of public health, I have 5 bonus articles available for reading online. I'll give you the link at the end. 1, deadly fungi are the newest emerging microbe threat all over the world. These pathogens already killed 1.6 million people every year, and we have few defenses against them. 2, shuttered hospitals, soaring COVID-19 deaths. Rural black communities lose a lifeline in the century's worst health crisis. 3, the food system is racist. An activist used a garden to tackle inequities. Renowned urban farmer Karen Washington coined the phrase food apartheid, and now the Bronx-based activist says a shift of power is urgent. 4, the time has come for a COVID-19 global Marshall Plan. And 5, opiate deaths and lockdowns, a complicated story. The short story is that the U.S. and Canada did poorly, but many other countries did not do so bad. It doesn't have to be this way. Okay, to read any of these 5 stories or to get links to the stories that are reported in the heart of the show, you can go to toppun.com/blog/WAKT. That's toppun.com/blog/WAKT. Thank you for spending this hour with me, my second most favorite hour of the week. I'll be signing off now from the Donald Trump Memorial Studio, and I'll be ending with a quote from the great Mahatma Gandhi. When I despair, I remember that all through history, the way of truth and love has always won. There have been tyrants and murderers, and for a time they can seem invincible. But in the end, they always fall. Always. And let's take it home with Emma's Revolution. I need some justice.